All right, given that I do have a story, I will get started. Morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out on a Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Today we're going to talk about volatiles. I'm very excited. So this image is from a Which one is the laser? That one. Okay. From Sarda and Graham, 1990. It is of a famous rock sample called the Popping Rock. Your seismologists have your famous earthquakes. The geochemists have our famous rocks. So this is from the North Atlantic. It was dredged from the mid-ocean ridge. And this was a rock that was so gas-rich that it started to pop apart when they dredged it. So these circles that you see that are illuminated, imagine a concave cavity there. These are vesicles. These are bubbles, gas bubbles. And this is a basaltic rock. So first of all, what do you notice? Shout things out and I'll repeat them.
Little blobs in the bubbles.
Little blobs in the bubbles. That might just be the reflection. But there are a lot of bubbles, right? This is really bubbly. Compared to most basalts, this is extremely vesicular.
And a lot of them are the same size.
A lot of them are the same size, which is very interesting. So the vesicularity of popping rock was estimated between 15 and 20% by volume. So if you had a rock, and 15 to 20% of it was just void spaces filled with gas. That's your popping rock. And the gas in these vesicles was at really high pressure. And so the way that they collect these rocks, they go out on a boat in the ocean, and they toss a glorified bucket over the side, and they let 4 kilometers of cable out until they see the cable go slack. That means that this dredge bucket has hit the bottom of the ocean floor, or has hit the ocean floor. And then they move the ship like a mile. And you see the tension in the cable rising and falling, and that's the bucket getting snagged on rocks on the seafloor, and sometimes scooping them in, winning the battle against the seafloor, and collecting rocks. And it's amazing that this works at all. The first cruise that I went on, I was like, there's no way this is gonna work. And actually, for the first 7 dredges, it didn't work. So dredge 8, we got our first samples, and I was like, wow, it worked. All right. Yeah, in some cases it's tearing pillows. Sometimes they're loose. Yeah, sometimes you dredge starfish and you feel really bad. Anyway, okay. So this rock, yeah. I saw a very faintly popping glass and I got inordinately excited about it and woke up all my friends. It was 3 in the morning. And we took a lot of pictures and we did a couple experiments. But this rock was so gas rich that the decrease in pressure from when they brought it from the seafloor to the surface, the decompression of the gas inside the bubbles was enough to overcome the strength of the rock. So it started to pop apart on deck. So it's called the popping rock. Can you imagine being crew on that ship, being like, devil rock, throw it back, it's cursed. Anyway, so this sample will come up later in the talk. I just wanted to show you an image of it. So we're talking about volatiles. Let's think back to Sujoy's lecture and recall what the definition of volatile was versus refractory. Anyone remember?
Temperature.
Temperature. Yes, the condensation temperature. So 1400, not really specific cutoffs will be avoided in this talk. But usually when you think about solids versus gases. You think solids at low temperatures, gases at high temperatures. Volatile and refractory elements are notable because the volatiles are gaseous even at low temperatures, and refractory species are solid even at high temperatures. That's how I like to think about it. So some examples of volatile species, H2O, CO2, nitrogen, noble gases, and then refractory elements like calcium, aluminum, we think these were the first things to condense from nebular gas. Other elements like rhenium and tungsten. What do you notice about these volatile elements or compounds? Life? Yeah, we can't live without these. H2O, CO2, nitrogen. I can't live without noble gases.
They're light.
Huh? So I'll add here that there are moderately volatile species. Sujoy showed these trends of volatility. And there's a lot of interest in moderately volatile species as well, such as potassium, rubidium, cadmium, and zinc. And an important sort of consideration is that speciation matters. So if you add elemental cadmium, it's actually much less volatile than cadmium chloride, which I learned in the lab after many months of trying to understand where my cadmium went. It's because when it was dissolved in hydrochloric acid, it evaporated. So similarly, carbon, if it's in CO2, you can have a solid diamond grain at a much higher temperature than CO2 ice, right? So speciation matters. Yeah. Oh, here's the one for this slide.
I'll try to shuffle it around.
Thank you.
Okay, so I have a question. Mm-hmm. I always think of magnesium as being refractory because I'm a seismologist,
sure.
But also because I imagine, like, okay, well, what are the inner planets made of? And it's essentially like magnesium. So why is that not on your list?
Oh, this is a very abbreviated list of refractories.
Okay.
So I would put magnesium on the refractory side as well.
And then for the carbon, you put carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
Would carbon monoxide be?
It should.
Yeah. I mean, which one's more abundant in, like?
Oh, dear. That is a question for someone who studies redox. Sarah? CO gas versus CO2 in the outer solar system?
CO2 for the inner solar system because of the oxidation state. CO in the outer solar system. And these volatiles in the bubbles are probably supercritical fluids, so don't think of them as the gases we're breathing.
Thank you.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about why we should care about volatiles. Earth's volatile-rich surface is clement for life. Now, it's important to note that volatiles are exchanged between surface reservoirs and the deep interior. So you might have changing distributions of volatiles between the deep Earth and surface reservoirs over time. Now, volatile abundances, especially of species like water, affect material properties. So the water content of silicates changes the viscosity of material. And so you can imagine that there are dynamic feedbacks at play between volatile cycling over billions of years and convection and plate tectonics. So there was a paper that came out of CIDR 2010 that looked at these dynamics by John Crowley et al. And to kind of give you a hint of where we're going to talk about major volatiles in the mantle. And then I'm going to develop a bit of noble gas geochemistry. You've already seen some xenon. We're going to talk about the other noble gases as tracers of both major volatiles and geodynamical processes broadly. Okay, so to review, yesterday you saw some radiogenic isotope geochemistry of mantle rocks. And this is showing a bunch of mantle-derived rock data in strontium, neodymium, lead space. And if you're a seismologist or a geodynamicist, you might look at this and be like, why are the axes in such non-traditional orientation? And the reason is that the point of this paper, this is from Hart et al. 1992, the point of this paper was that if you take a whole bunch of measurements of strontium, neodymium, and lead in mantle-derived samples and plot them in this three-isotope space, the observation was that most of the data fell within a tetrahedron. And that was really interesting because it meant that you could model the compositions inside the tetrahedron as mixtures of four n-member components. And so we've already heard about these components, EM1, enriched mantle 1, enriched mantle 2, which is probably sediments, high mu, which we think is recycled oceanic crust, and the depleted morb mantle. So it's not just sort of random organization within this tetrahedron. If you go at a single hotspot chain, you see these kind of mixing trends for individual hotspots. So that's really interesting. You're potentially seeing mixing between distinct components at each of these hotspot chains. So as several people have noted, what we want to be able to do is take this geochemical information and extract the implications for geodynamics in the Earth's interior. So volatiles are also tracers of geophysical processes. This is a distinct and complementary set of tools that we can use to extract information from mental data arrays. As a philosophical point, this is echoing what Sujoy said earlier, we use as many tools as possible with the caveat that different systems are sensitive to different physical processes. So you always have to be aware what system, what processes affect the system that I'm thinking about right now. So for instance, we've talked about hafnium tungsten being sensitive to core formation. Because tungsten is siderophile, so it goes into the core, where hafnium is lithophile, so it stays in the mantle. So if I were trying to understand a degassing process or partial melting process, hafnium tungsten has this core formation signature, it wouldn't be an ideal system to think about that process. Similarly, if two different systems are giving me what feels like conflicting information, but one system is sensitive to degassing and the other is sensitive to core formation, it shouldn't worry me, right? I should be kind of okay with it. These are two distinct systems sensitive to different processes, so they're telling us different stories. Everyone on board with that? All right. And it's worthwhile to note that some systems are affected by many physical processes. So for example, hafnium tungsten is affected by metal silicate partitioning. But if you have crystallization of a magma ocean, you can also fractionate hafnium from tungsten. So going forward, what I'm going to kind of try to play up is that noble gases exhibit pretty simple behavior relative to many other systems. All right, so first, let's start off by talking about volatile abundances. What volatiles are where in the Earth? Approximately how much? How well do we know these numbers? So this is my one and only table, and we'll spend some time on it, so don't furiously jot it down. You'll have the slides online as well. So this is going down with depth, my atmosphere and oceans. None of this is to scale. Crust. Morb source, so morb is mid-ocean ridge basalt. This is what geochemists call the upper mantle. The plume source, where we declined to specify where it is physically, but it is the source of mantle plumes. What am I missing in between here? That all of the mantle, the transition zone specifically. So this is a geochemist's diagram, right? We can't say anything really about the transition zone because we don't have a set of samples that we're like, ah, yes, this is from the transition zone, except maybe diamonds. All right, so then the outer core and the inner core. And you'll notice that the certainty is going to decrease as we go down because we're going from something that's very accessible to less and less accessible reservoirs. So I'll start at the top and go across. H2O in the atmosphere is variable. It goes with the weather. Anything from very, very dry, so close to zero, up to a couple percent, and I think on average, a couple tenths of a percent for the atmosphere by weight is H2O. CO2, now 410 ppm by volume in the atmosphere. Oceans, approximately 100 ppm. Nitrogen, most of the atmosphere is nitrogen, 78% by volume. And the oceans, I looked this up, it's not that easy to find, 10 to 50 ppm. So the noble gases are trace in the atmosphere except for argon. Argon makes almost a percent of the atmosphere. Why might that be? Yeah. Yeah, so you have a substantial budget of argon from decay of potassium-40, and potassium is a major element. But we'll talk about the argon budget next week in the tutorial and sort of dig into these different problems. So parts per million neon, parts per million helium, and less xenon, yeah.
Does any, you know, argon is a little heavier than other things. Does it actually factor into the atmospheric concentration at all, or is it entirely just...
Is there a trend with mass?
Yeah.
So it'll drop back down. So krypton is much less abundant, xenon is much less abundant.
Okay, yeah. Yep.
Okay, so within the crust, H2O gets to about a tenth of a percent by weight. And then you could look at that and compare that to the numbers below and be like, wow, that's really water rich. But remember, the crust is a small percentage of the solid Earth by mass. Right? So in the total budget, this tenth of a weight percent isn't quite so impressive. Yeah. It's continental. Yeah. Sorry, I should have said that. Continental crust. So CO2, less than 1% by weight, nitrogen, some ppm. Noble gases, I actually didn't bother. It's small. For the MORB source, this is going to be numbers based on measurements of mid-ocean ridge basalt. H2O, we think 50 to 200 parts per million. CO2, 30 to 150. And I'm just going to stay with H2O and CO2 and go down to the plume source. Compared to 50 to 200 ppm, for the plume source, we think 400 to probably about 1,000, 1,200 ppm. And then CO2, 500 to 3,000. So what's the observation? Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick question about the plume source. We have a lot of measurements of water and some of these volatiles and basalt from the MORB source, but is the plume source just basically measurements in Hawaii?
No, there are other ocean island basalt melt inclusion measurements, not just Hawaii. So there's at least Hawaii. I'm struggling to remember the data set. It was from 2012, but my 2012 water paper with Sujoy has a compilation. So if you're comparing this set of numbers with this set of numbers, what's the primary observation? You can shout it out. The plume source seems to be wetter and higher in CO2 than the MORB source. So that's a primary observation. If we keep going across, less than 2 ppm nitrogen, highly uncertain for plumes, probably also on the ppm level. And then over in noble gases, I've actually merged the plume source and the MORB source. There's a reason for that. I wanted to give you a sense of the order of magnitude. So 4E minus 9 grams per gram, so that would be parts per billion. E minus 12 for neon. Argon has a higher abundance. And then xenon drops to the E minus 14, E minus 13 grams per gram. So
Rita, I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Sorry. How is nitrogen? I guess I don't know my mineralogy, but like I don't know off the top of my head any relevant nitrogen-bearing minerals.
Dear, this
is it just like interstitial? What? How does it go?
Sujoy.
So nitrogen turns out it can substitute for potassium as NH3+.
As ammonium?
So there are ammonium.
Okay.
Ammonium,
NH4+.
Can you say it into the mic?
Nitrides are possible candidates that have been invoked as a inner core alloy, although, of course, the concentration could be quite low. But ammonium, as Sujoy mentioned, there are minerals like tobolite and buddingtonite, feldspar, and micas, which may have trace quantities of ammonium in bizarre locations.
Yeah. Okay. That answers your question? All right, so the noble gases, the point that I would like to make here is that their abundances are very low compared to everything else, right? So these are sometimes called the rare gases. And their abundances are also very uncertain. So these are completely different units, so just ignore the units. But these are two relatively recent papers that tried to estimate the bulk mantle noble gas concentrations, as well as carbon and nitrogen. And you notice that they're different order of magnitude estimates, right? So let's see, what's a bad one? 1 times 10 to the, so approximately 12 versus 0.8, right? So highly uncertain. Why might this be? It's really hard to measure noble gases, first of all, just generally, but also these samples are very degassed. So if you're trying to reconstruct what the mantle composition was before melting and then before degassing that melt, it's a very tricky thing to do. So going back to this table, if you look at the core, I started to get a bit flippant because as a geochemist, I really can't say, right? I don't have samples that would tell me about these, but there's some light element in the core, which I assume is in the outer core, but we heard a bit about, no? Okay, Sun is saying no. The inner core could have volatiles as well. So my hydrogen maybe and then go away with noble gases in the inner core, I'm not really sure. All right, so one more diagram, this is from Dominique's talk yesterday. I really like this abundance diagram because the poor noble gases, right? You can't even see them. It's like a skyscraper plot, right? And we're the poor low rises no one will ever see.
Yeah, but you can't see it.
We can. So challenges in constraining mental or earth volatile budgets. We are looking at the products of partial melting generally, and degassing of melts makes it difficult to constrain mantle source abundances. There's also the problem of which samples are actually representative. Was that popping rock representative of the upper mantle? Or did you have some process like bubble accumulation in a magma chamber? Do you have to worry about these sorts of things? And then if you're talking about noble gases, for heavy noble gases, you also have to worry about pervasive atmospheric contamination, which can overprint the mantle signature. All right, so let's get into some geochemical behavior of volatile species. Carbon dioxide is incompatible during partial melting, strongly degassed from erupted melts, but there are many complicating factors like the redox state, kinetics. And then H2O is fairly incompatible, but not all that incompatible. It has a D of about 0.01, which is similar to cerium during partial melting. And this degasses at lower pressures than CO2. So we can see this on a plot. This is from Mitrick and Wallace, showing CO2 parts per million versus H2O weight percent in melt inclusions. And each of these data points represents measurement of a different melt inclusion. And the curves, the solid curves, are theoretical degassing trends. And then these contours are pressure contours. So as you're degassing because you are decompressing the melt, going to a lower pressure. And so the shape of these curves should tell you your CO2 is degassing first, so your CO2 abundance is dropping, but the H2O abundance is not dropping that much. And then finally, when you get to relatively low pressures, you start to degas the H2O. So if I were to take a sample and measure a bunch of melt inclusions and see a vertical trend in a plot like this, I might become really happy because it would tell me that, okay, CO2 is degassing, but the H2O hasn't started degassing yet. So maybe I have a better estimate of that magma's primary H2O content than otherwise. Yeah.
Normally, when we talk about incompatible elements, we're talking about a single element. So why can you treat water and CO2 as a unit that's moving?
This is a philosophical question. So if it's exsolving as a species, as CO2, I think you can treat it as a unit rather than oxygen and carbon. So it's going to follow the pressure temperature relations for that species. Yeah. OK, so how do we actually, yeah?
What do we mean by redox state?
this is a tricky definition. So the oxygen fugacity, if I had a whole bunch of iron.
So what do you mean by oxygen fugacity?
Yes, that's what I'm starting
okay.
to. So let's say I had a bunch of iron in my silicate, and I measured how much was in the +2 state versus the +3 state. If more of it was in the +3 state, this would be more oxidizing conditions. And so the redox state would refer to how oxidized are the species and are the cations.
Does that make them more likely to react with the oxygen?
So remember how we talked about the diamonds versus the CO2?
Yeah.
So in a diamond, you'd have reduced carbon. In the CO2, your carbon is oxidized. So you might have different behavior, and you might have a better answer. Yeah?
I'm just trying to chime in to clarify the thing. In the nature, there are oftentimes rocks which will have combination of minerals. So those combination of minerals could be like phaolite, which is a version of olivine, magnetite, and quartz. So this is typically known as FMQ. So that sets up an oxidized that indicates that probably the mantle is oxidized because phaolite and magnetite are coexisting, Fe2+ and Fe3+. Now, if you go to a region where you do not have any magnetite or phaolite, but you may still have FeO, existing with iron, that is called iron wustite kind of buffer, and that's probably a bit more reduced. So we may not see the oxygen itself that is participating in the reaction because it probably escaped, but it indicates the partial pressure of the oxygen in the system. Does this make sense? Somebody else might?
Thanks. Okay, so how do we actually make these measurements? This is a panel from an XKCD cartoon. Sana inspired me to look to XKCD for explanations of how geochemists feel in the lab. The first couple of panels of this cartoon are about, this was Spirit. It was like day one, a 30-day mission. Only 29 more days till I get to go home. And then day 31, it was like, guys, day 897 of 90, I thought I analyzed that rock really well. That's how we feel in the lab. measuring H2O and CO2 abundances, if you're worrying about degassing, there's a strategy that you can deploy to try to minimize degassing. You can look at melt inclusions in minerals like olivine to try to minimize the effect of degassing. So these were little pockets of melt that were trapped in olivine as that olivine was crystallizing in a magma chamber, and potentially trapped melt that had experienced less degassing. And so this is an image sent to me by Jonathan Tucker, who's doing a lot of these types of measurements right now at DTM, of individual olivine grains, these are millimeter scale each, pressed into indium. So indium is a relatively soft metal. You press your grains into the indium, and then you spend hours and hours polishing the grains, and then looking under a microscope and trying to see if you've actually exposed a melt inclusion embedded within these grains. And once you have exposed these melt inclusions, you're like, yes, finally, yes. Question?
Why indium and not just like putting it in, you know, like epoxy or something? Is it for fear of contamination from the epoxy? Or?
Yeah, so epoxy has a lot of, especially if you're looking at volatiles, indium is going to be a better blank.
I have another question. So when you said you polish it until you, expose the melt inclusion, doesn't that degas it then or contaminate it?
So this is for CO2 and H2O dissolved in the melt. So if you had gas trapped in bubbles and you exposed those bubbles, yes, those would go away.
Okay, but yeah. This won't.
This shouldn't.
Like in the, and of course, this is no longer melt.
This is no longer melt. It is now a glass. Okay, yes, thank you for pointing that out. So when these lavas erupted, they had the olivines with the melt inclusions in them. Once they were at the surface, that melt cooled very quickly, hopefully, and then you got a glass. And so looking at a zoomed-in melt inclusion, this is actually smaller. This is about a 0.3 millimeter across olivine, and then this is an irregular melt inclusion inside. And what you want to be able to do is polish this olivine, expose that melt inclusion, and then measure it, typically in one of two ways. So the workhorses for H2O and CO2 are Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy, also known as FTIR, and secondary ionization mass spectrometry, known as SIMS. So FTIR, this is non-destructive. You're going to polish actually both sides of your sample, get a nice flat piece of a known thickness, shine a beam of infrared light on it, and based on what's absorbed, figure out how much H2O or CO2 is in that sample by comparing it to standards of known concentration. Does that make sense? Okay, for secondary ionization mass spectrometry, you look at this thing, you're like, that looks crazy. But in reality, all mass spectrometers are very simple. Well, they have three fundamental parts, and everything is just variations on those three fundamental parts. For every mass spectrometer, keep this tucked away in your brain every time you hear about geochemical measurements. Every mass spectrometer has a source of ions, so some sort of mechanism to ionize your sample, some sort of separation mechanism to separate those ions by mass, and then a detector, or multiple detectors, to count those ions. So some different examples of ways of ionizing your sample are thermal ionization. That's when you'd have a metal filament and you would drop your dissolved sample onto that metal filament, dry it into a spot, and then heat up that filament until you start to ionize your sample directly off of it. secondary ionization. In this case, you have an ion gun, which is awesome, and you shoot cesium ions at your sample. And those cesium ions, or oxygen ions, will hit the surface of your sample and sputter off a bunch of your sample, some of which will be ionized. And so the ionized bits of your sample are then accelerated towards your separation mechanism. Another one you might hear about is inductively coupled plasma, ICP-MS. This one is sort of the most visually impressive to me, because there's this blue argon plasma that you can see. And I kind of think of it, like flame breathers or fire breathers who are spitting and lighting that whatever it is on fire. Imagine an argon plasma flame, and then you have your sample in solution, and you're spitting your sample into that argon plasma flame and letting it get ionized. You're not actually spitting it. There's a nebulizer that does that for you. All right, and then for gases, like noble gases, you just have a really hot filament that is spewing off electrons, and those electrons can ionize your gas species. This is called gas source mass spectrometry. So then over in the separator column, two very common types, magnetic sector. I have my ionized samples, right? So my ions are being accelerated. If they go through a magnetic field, their paths will curve, and the curvature of their path will depend on mass. So lighter species will bend more. More massive species will bend less. Another option for separation is time of flight. So let's say I didn't bend their path at all. I was just shooting them all towards a detector in one pulse. And then I wait to see which ions arrive when. The lightest ones will arrive first. The heavier ones will arrive later. And then lastly, for detectors, don't have to go into nitty-gritty, but sort of depending on the size of your beam, you might want a different detector. So if you have a large signal, a Faraday cup, it's basically just a metal cup. And depending on the rate of ions bombarding that cup, you get a different current, which is translated to a voltage. And an electron multiplier, this is for lower signals. This actually amplifies your signal if you have low counts. So secondary ionization mass spectrometry to measure H2O and CO2, doing that secondary ionization where you sputter your sample, separate by a magnetic sector, and then maybe collect on an electron multiplier. That make sense? Okay. So what am I going to do with these measurements? I've measured a whole bunch of H2O and CO2 concentrations in, let's say, arc melt inclusions, ocean island melt inclusions, and mid-ocean ridge basalt glasses. I want to be able to put these into a broader context, because ultimately what I want to think about is deep earth volatile cycling. What are the fluxes? Where do things go? So this is a schematic diagram showing the exosphere. If you haven't seen this term before, the exosphere is a real thing in the atmosphere, which low temperature geochemists and atmospheric dynamicists worry about. But solid earth geochemists call the exosphere everything outside the mantle. So the crust, the oceans, and the atmosphere. Mark Hirschman, I think in a Daily lecture, once said that the exosphere is everything the mantle didn't want and wouldn't take back. Stayed with me. All right, so fluxes between the mantle and the exosphere. You have magmatic outputs, so every time you melt or partially melt the mantle, you will preferentially put volatiles into the melt, and then those melts will degas at the surface. So you have a flux from the mantle to the exosphere at ocean islands, a flux at mid-ocean ridges, and even though mid-ocean ridge basalts had lower volatile contents, it's a little less than a factor of 10 more volcanic output at mid-ocean ridges compared to ocean islands in the present day. Might have been different in the past. So these are two outputs. At subduction zones, something very interesting is happening. Subduction zones are your opportunity to input volatiles into the mantle. And you'll have some initial volatile content in the slab. We'll talk more about that in the next slide. And of this initial input, some portion is going to come back out the arc system, either through arc volcanisms or back arc volcanism. And then anything that's left in that subducting slab beyond depths of magma generation is going to be a return flux to the mantle from the exosphere. Does that make sense? All right. So the net flux is going to be the blue arrows versus the dark green arrow. right? So this sort of yellowish system was just in and out. So if you want to talk about the net flux, you have to think about magmatic outputs and then a return flux. All right, so in a little more detail, what's actually carrying volatiles in our subducting slab? You have this oceanic plate that's been sitting under a whole bunch of seawater for tens to hundreds of millions of years. There was a lot of hydrothermal circulation at the mid-ocean ridge, and then you deposited a bunch of sediments on top of that. So your subducting slab package has sediments on top of altered oceanic crust, and then potentially, some people think that this might happen very close to the subduction zone itself, if you have what's it called, outerized faulting, sort of percolation of water into those faults could reach the lithospheric mantle and serpentinize the olivine at the top of the lithosphere. So in that case, you have, say, clays, which are water-rich in the sediments. You have carbonate in the sediments. You have altered oceanic crust, which can have amphibole, which is water-rich. Can have carbonatized the oceanic crust as well. And then serpentinite. So those would be sort of the big important phases and carriers of volatiles. So you have this trench input, and then as that slab reaches higher pressures and temperatures, you have breakdown. Well, first you have expulsion of pore fluids at relatively shallow depths. So we think we squeeze out most of the, say, water that's sitting in pore spaces and sediments or in cracks. And then as you get to higher pressures and temperatures, you start to break down hydrous mineral phases. And as those hydrous minerals break down, they release water, and there's a fluid phase now for things to partition into. So every time you have a fluid phase, you're kind of querying all the material that's in contact with that fluid phase, would you like to donate anything, right? And then if there's something that would prefer the fluid phase, it'll go into that. So whatever's left in the slab after devolatilization is our return flux. So the devolatilization, and thus the regassing, depends on the pressure temperature path. This is a figure from Hacker, 2008, showing increasing pressure, so depth increases as you go up, and increasing temperature. And it is contoured by water contents across this PT field, where the purple is 11.6 weight percent water, so quite water rich, and then going all the way to less than a tenth of a percent water. And there are two paths traced here that start off to the left. This is hot subduction, so relatively, say, a relatively young plate versus cold subduction, relatively old plate. And what do you notice between these two paths? You see that the cold subduction, once it gets to 4 GPa, it's still in the 11.6 purple field, right? So it got to a significant depth and still retained a high water content. And so if it's past the depth of magma generation and it kept that water, then that's a significant return flux to the deep earth. But this hot subduction path, you devolatilized what you had in that slab, and you have a relatively dry or low return flux at the end of that path. Any questions on this? Yeah.
This doesn't directly relate to those paths, but what is that strange feature at like 2 GPa?
This thing?
Yeah.
Oh dear, I don't know. Does anyone here know one? is there a mic for?
Showing the phase boundaries where individual hydrous phases dehydrate, and that particular contrast of green and yellow could be related to something called choke point. And that is what we are not quite sure about a particular phase, which is called 10 angstrom phase. It's a modification of talc, whether that's going to be stable there or not. And there's a missing link there between the relay race of hydrous phases which can take water there. If you want, I can talk about more.
I have another question. So these geotherms, I guess, that you're drawing for hot subduction and cold subduction, this, all of the packages that you talked about that were relevant for volatiles were very shallow in the slab. So do these pertain really to the top 5 kilometers of the subducting slab? Because I think like 300 C is like
like frigid.
That's a good point. I'm not totally sure. I'd have to go back and look at the paper, but I thought that they had accounted for depth.
Okay.
But it's true that if you had serpentinite at the level of where oceanic crust would be, that wouldn't be valid. Yeah.
I'm just surprised because I guess Esteban showed us how hot these things, how hot I guess the, was it like the melange? I forgot what the figure was, but it was like hot.
Hotter than this at that pressure.
Like many
degrees
hotter.
I'm trying to remember in this paper if the hot and cold were from a particular model or if they were just drawn, because I've noticed there's a lot of papers where they just say, this is what
cold
you
would
need
do.
To be in a hot situation, and this is what you would need to stay cold, but it's actually not based on technically a physical model. I like the Syracuse 2010 paper because they actually have like real models of how the heat propagate in the slab as it goes down.
Right.
So that kind of helps with Ved's question because it takes the difference between like what the basalt would be experiencing versus what the peridotite would be experiencing during the subduction process.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make a comment about this to answer that. So these are two PT paths of cold and hot subduction, and then they are more quantitative. I'm pretty sure this came from a model, not just drawing it, because at the end, Brad is a co-author in all these things. He's actually the one that calculated the phase equilibria and all the Syracuse and Evers and all those papers. The difference between the melange idea and this is that this is a slab going down very nicely, and then you have the breakdown of phases as the slab proceeds in the subduction system, as you explained in the figure before.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also the other option that at a certain point these materials become unstable, and then they separate, and then they go to the nose of the mantle wedge and they melt. So that would be the explanation for the melange versus, and I don't know how you can say this other model, nice, easy subduction model.
A straightforward
subduction versus melange. And to be honest, I think everything is a mix in between those two models.
Right, and to reemphasize for people who aren't quite as familiar with subduction zones, if you have material leaving the slab and getting mixed into the mantle wedge flow, which is going to be hotter, then you'd be experiencing higher temperatures.
And also still, going on of what Ved was asking, we have to remember this is a model.
Mm-hmm.
And models are not reality, they're just models. And in fact, there's plenty of people who've been saying that models in subduction zone close to the surface subduction interface are too cold.
Mm-hmm.
And have been hunting for ways to make those models hotter exactly in these conditions here. So yeah, the temperature is probably lower than in reality here.
Yeah.
This is maybe an overly simplistic question, but just looking at this, it seems like you would get a big change in the arc volcanism between cold and hot. Is that something that's observed on Earth?
Esteban should answer that, yeah.
So in my presentation, I showed the trace element geochemistry, and it's very clear that metals coming from a cold subduction have their own fingerprint that they suggest that they come from, you know, just squeezing fluids versus melts that are in a hot subduction or in a melange, that they will show partial melts. So they do show that fingerprint. So it's consistent, I think, with the model.
Yeah. So going back to what Laurent said, the sort of assertion that these slabs have temperatures might be too cold sort of jives with one of the studies that I did with Sujoy, where we tried to get a handle on the uncertainties in all of these fluxes. And our main takeaway from that study was that the return flux has got to be a lot lower than previous estimates. So there's a lot less of this and more of this. Not going to talk about that today, but yeah. Okay. So H2O, CO2, we talked about their geochemical behavior. Noble gases, these are chemically inert, incompatible, and pretty insoluble in melts. So they will degas quite readily. So we're going to shift from CO2 and H2O into noble gases. Were there any other comments or questions about the major volatiles before I do that? Can we get a mic for...
So one of these main questions you're trying to answer is, what is the original CO2 and H2O content of the mantle based on some of these volatile rich rocks?
Okay.
So can you look at something like isotopic fractionation to account for how much degassing has happened? And maybe, like, can you use how much isotopic fractionation has happened to correct for degassing to get the original content?
So during degassing, we think that there's minimal isotopic fractionation. So of your CO2 that's being degassed, carbon-12 versus carbon-13 is not going to have a big effect on it. But there are interesting isotopic fingerprints that you can use about different inputs of, say, CO2 into the mantle. Carbonate has a different carbon isotopic signature than, say, sediments versus basalt. So you can play those sorts of games, but the degassing extent, I don't think you can constrain isotopically.
Can I keep that? Okay. One thing that can be done is using the DH ratio. Mm-hmm. Remember the multi-collision? There's going to be some diffusivity or degassing too. And you can use the deuterium-hydrogen ratio from the multi-collision into the olivine and know how much that hydrogen went away.
Right. So that's a special case. So diffusion is going to fractionate isotopes based on their mass. And especially for hydrogen, the difference between deuterium and hydrogen is 100%, right? So that's a big mass difference. There was another question on this side.
Yeah, I just wondered if maybe you had a comment or opinion on mm-hmm. why your MORB source and plume source H2O contents are so dramatically different than diamond inclusions.
Ah.
Is that just a chemical heterogeneity, or do you have an opinion?
This is my shruggy. I'm not sure. So the, as I understand it, the diamond concentrations are higher, right?
Yeah.
Yes, much higher.
Like 1%.
Right.
The ice inclusion.
So they might be coming from They might be coming from a region in the mantle that has concentrated water. They might be coming coming out of a phase that had somehow concentrated water. That's my only vague answer. Yep, James, can we get the mic up here, Beth?
What were you saying? How is hydrogen stored in the mantle?
So I always actually get tripped up on this, because when people talk about water, often they're talking about hydrogen that's chemically bound. Does anyone have a better? Can you repeat the question?
Is it working?
It works after 2 seconds.
How is hydrogen stored in the mantle? Especially because a lot of the hydrous minerals, it's OH groups.
So there are nominally anhydrous minerals that can still hold quite a bit of water. But in terms of where they go into crystal lattices, do you have a...
Try to talk about that next week, maybe,
And
keep the mystery.
Okay. Sarah says OH. Just shove OHs everywhere. Okay. Ready for noble gases? Okay. All right, so noble gases are atmophile. We've talked about siderophiles, we've talked about lithophiles, now the atmophiles. Given any opportunity to exit the mantle, they will pretty much do so. So they're incompatible in the mantle during partial melting, and then are strongly degassed from the melt into the atmosphere. So, like, noble gases are like the small town kid who wants to be on Broadway, right? I hate this crystal lattice. To be in the atmosphere. So you have a flux of noble gases from the mantle to the atmosphere. And for a long time, we thought that this was a one-way street, that mantle processing was a one-way street for noble gases out of the mantle. But now we know that regassing of the heavy noble gases, so argon, potentially krypton and xenon, occurs. So we'll get to that later in the talk. Already mentioned that noble gases are very low in their abundance. This ends up being a really important point. Noble gases are scarce enough to be isotopically sensitive to decay and fission, even when the radioactive parent is rare itself. So even when you have a trace amount of uranium, can have a strong effect on the radiogenic helium signature because there's so little helium to begin with. So instead of these part per million variations that we see in, say, 142 neodymium versus 142 to 144 neodymium, we're talking factors of 10, factors of 1,000, even 1,000? No, 100 variations. These are not subtle, which helps us because they're hard to measure. So here's a noble gas primer, and this is, I'm going to simplify this greatly, but you have isotopes of helium, neon, argon, xenon. There are so many isotopes of xenon, I had to do this little abbreviated list of those three. And in reality, okay, I've skipped krypton because we haven't measured it very well. I'm going to simplify all of this into two classes of noble gas isotopes. We have noble gas isotopes that are produced by radioactive decay. These are radiogenic. And throughout the talk, these will be in this bright, glowing green, so you can remember that they were produced by radioactive decay. And the soothing purple is our primordial isotopes. These are stable, so they're not going away. They're non-radiogenic, they're not being produced. And so the budget of your primordial volatile tiles that you have is what's been in the Earth since accretion. So two classes. And then if we go back to this horrible chart, I can color code them, and now you're like, ah, all I have to see is green and purple. So the takeaway from this chart is that for every element, there is at least one radiogenic and one primordial isotope. So for helium, you have helium-3, which is primordial, helium-4, which is produced by any alpha decay. So an alpha particle is just a helium-4 nucleus. So the main producers of helium-4 are uranium and thorium. So those are the parents there. For neon, I have two primordial isotopes, 20 and 22. 21 is produced by nuclear reactions in association with alpha decay. So every time you have an alpha decay, there's some probability that that alpha particle will react with, say, an oxygen 18 and produce neon 21 and emit another neutron. It's called an alpha-N reaction. For argon, I have two primordial isotopes, 36 and 38, and then I have radiogenic argon-40 produced by the decay of potassium-40. And then down here with the xenon list, 3 plus 1, so 4 primordial isotopes of xenon. 129 xenon is produced by the radioactive decay of iodine-129. That's a short-lived radioactive species. And then I'm going to color these a slightly different neon color, so neon blue for the heavy isotopes of xenon, and that's because instead of sort of alpha decay or beta decay, these are fission products where plutonium and uranium undergo spontaneous fission on different length scales or different time scales to produce the heavy isotopes of xenon. So I'm going to make an assertion here and then explain it. If you have a reservoir that is more degassed, you'll have a high ratio of radiogenic to primordial isotopes. So this is going to be our Saturday morning cartoon. This is our thought experiment. We have a mantle box, and I have drawn a whole bunch of helium-3 and helium-4, and I'm going to degas this mantle box. So in my next time step, poof, a whole bunch of helium-3 and helium-4 degasses. There's a little bit left behind, but you lose both isotopes during degassing. What stayed behind in the melt other than the helium? If you're degassing, what doesn't leave the melt? All the lithophiles, right? So there's still a lot of uranium, well, not a lot, but there's still uranium in that mantle box. So uranium was retained, and then over time, that uranium is going to decay. And so in my exaggerated cartoon here, all of that uranium decayed and produced helium-4. So you note that only the radiogenic isotope grows back over time. So you lose both isotopes, but you only get more helium-4. So degassing plus time gives you a higher radiogenic to primordial ratio. So then going back to this chart, if I have a degassed mantle reservoir, it should have a high ratio of helium-4 to helium-3. It should have a high ratio of neon-21 to neon-22. It should have a high ratio of argon-40 to 36. Each of those is a radiogenic to primordial pair. Down here it gets a little trickier. If I have degassing, I get a high ratio of 129 to, say, 130, if the degassing occurred during the lifetime of iodine-129. So this is going to be sensitive to early degassing, and this is where you start to think, okay, the half-lives of these radioactive parents matters. And so iodine-129 has a half-life of about 16 million years, so it's sensitive to degassing for the first 90 million years of Earth history. And then plutonium-244 has a half-life of 80 million years, so about 400 million years of sensitivity to degassing. And then uranium-238 is still ticking away. Its half-life is about the age of the Earth. All right, so then we can organize these systems on a timeline of Earth history. So this is the beginning of the solar system's formation of CAIs, and this is the present day. If you're interested in problems having to do with the early Earth, accretion, origins of volatiles, moon-forming giant impact, early degassing, then the systems that are sensitive to those processes are iodine xenon and plutonium xenon. If you're interested in long-term processes, the systems of interest are going to be your radiogenic helium, nucleogenic neon, radiogenic argon, and then the uranium fission derived xenon. So you can kind of organize these into your head. We're going to talk mostly about these systems in this talk, and then next week talk more about early formed heterogeneities, which Sujoy has already talked about. We'll sort of tie it all back together. So we're sitting here at the present day, and we're looking back at this integrated history. All of these processes have left their signature on the noble gas composition of the mantle. And so what we want to be able to do is to measure things with sufficient precision to be able to tease apart these different signatures, which is a challenge. Any questions so far? All sold on why noble gases are awesome? Yes.
Sorry, I keep having questions, but so with helium, you showed them degassing at the same, like, equivalently, but it seems like it's so puny that the relative difference between 3 and 4 would be significant. Is that just not the case?
So they're also diffusing quite quickly. So if your degassing is happening with, let's say, you form a CO2 bubble, I think there should not be an isotopic fractionation because diffusion is so quick that what you end up with in that bubble is the same. Anything else?
So for the U-fission-derived xenon, I guess xenon, it must be a puny concentration if the fission products affects it, because fission is, I don't even remember the branching ratio, like 0.1%, maybe that.
It's very small, yeah. So this is a really small input, because there's so little xenon to start with, it's a resolvable signal.
And so if I recall earlier, you said, I think maybe you said xenon in the mantle was 10^-12?
Less.
So, okay, so can you actually resolve that in a mass spectrometer?
With a very special mass spectrometer and a lot of work. We'll talk a little bit about methods. Yep. But it is difficult to do, and you'll notice that as we go to heavier gases, there are fewer samples. So I'll show a helium plot with tons of data, and then you'll see the xenon plots, and you're like, only 4 locations. All right. So for noble gas mass spectrometry, same idea. You have a source of ions. In this case, it is the really hot filament that's spewing electrons. This is our gas source. You separate things by mass using a big magnet, and then detect things on a Faraday cup versus an electron multiplier. But because these are rare gases, generally we're doing our measurements on these electron multipliers that give you amplified signals. Sujoy, apologies, I didn't ask your permission, but I took a picture of your lab. Okay, so this is Sujoy's lab at UC Davis showing a noble gas mass spectrometer. All of this is the electronics. The actual flight tube is just this tiny, skinny thing. And so if you do plasma mass spectrometry and you look at this and you're like, what, this is tiny, there's a reason for that. So you're going to put your sample into this small volume and then close the valve. This is a static measurement. And then you have that hot filament emitting electrons. And so what you want to do is minimize the volume so that you maximize the probability that your gas will interact with that electron beam and become ionized. If you have a huge volume, then you're going to have a small signal because you're not very efficiently ionizing your very tiny number of gas atoms. Does that make sense? So once you've ionized your gas, it goes through this magnetic field, it's accelerated towards a magnetic field, separated, and the detectors are on this side. This is Sujoy's nifty laser, so there are different ways of releasing gas from samples. You can zap it with a laser to release the gas, you can physically crush your sample, or you could stick it in a furnace and step heat it. So since we are shifting from sort of volatile cycling more into mantle heterogeneity, just wanted to have this sort of framing cartoon. What can geochemists infer about Earth's interior? We're the happy geochemists that rove around the surface collecting rocks from beautiful ocean islands and mid-ocean ridges and arcs. And we infer things about the sources of these rocks based on the differences in the chemistry that we see. So Dominique talked about these different geochemical arrays that we have. So this is not to scale. So this is my present-day Morb source, present-day Plume source, with lots and lots of heterogeneity. I had a lot of fun in Illustrator doing this. So the mid-ocean ridge basalt sample a mantle source that's distinct from the source sampled by plumes. What does this look like in noble gas isotopes? So for helium isotopes in mantle rocks, this is a Caltech plot. It's something versus nothing. The y-axis is just arbitrary ordering, separated into mid-ocean ridge basalts and then ocean island basalt at the bottom. And then the axis on the bottom, this is helium-4-3, right? So it's radiogenic over primordial. And if you have a high ratio of radiogenic to primordial, this is more degassed on the right, less degassed on the left. And so what do you notice? You see all these mid-ocean ridge basalts sort of clustering in this band, and then you see these wide variations in a single location ocean island chain. So two observations. One is that MORBs exhibit less heterogeneity, and the other is that on average, if you look at sort of the centroid of that cloud, the ocean island basalt chains have values that are less degassed than the mid-ocean ridge basalts. But they also have values that are more degassed, right? So you have these highly heterogeneous signatures at ocean island basalts of less degassed and more degassed helium. And then you have your relatively homogeneous mid-ocean ridge basalts, but that is a simplification. It's averaging over many ridge segments. Yes?
So, is there any difference between their MOB and OIB in terms of their parent of the helium?
Of the uranium content? On average, I would say a slight difference, but it's not, it's less than a factor of two. And then the difference in their helium isotopes is going to exceed what you would expect from that difference.
Thank you.
It's also in the opposite direction. Yeah.
So, easy question, but it dawned on me that I didn't actually know the answer. Yeah. So for the MORB samples, are these only taken actually at the ridge, or are there samples that, you know, are taken further from the ridge, you know, like, and this remains that constant?
No, most of them are zero H, so most of them are dredged right at the ridge.
So how does it change, or does it change? Like, do the isotopes change? Does the major element chemistry change as you go further from the ridge?
It does. So there are a lot of intricacies. So you could think about the difference in the major elements and stuff. That's going to reflect the melting process. So if you had variations in melt volume, et cetera, over time, those would change. Dominique is going to say something. And the isotopes, it's difficult to measure helium away from the ridge axis because that's very degassed and altered material.
When you look at, you want to look at the isotopes, whatever they are, and even the noble gas to trace the mantle, you don't want to go too far away because then you're going to deal with alteration. And you won't have the primary signal. For instance, uranium is very mobile and it's going to wash away. And we see that for many things. Yeah. So if you look at, depending, again, it's the right tool for the right question, depending what you want to look at, if you want to look at the mantle signal, you're trying to have the freshest samples as possible, and that
right.
works for you too.
I would add to that. So like in a perfect world, if the parent and daughter stayed the same and stayed in the rock, and it was a nice closed system as it went away from the ridge axis. In that perfect world, you can measure that and be like, ah, I can backtrack what this was when it erupted. And then you could say, here's what erupted at the ridge over time. But in a practical sense, that's not what we have. Yeah.
So it's not possible to, I mean, you know, we've got almost 200 million years of crust, of oceanic crust. So, I mean, even on just the major element chemistry, like, are we not able to see changes? Or can we infer changes, like, without any, or without any alterations, like changes in melt fraction? Or is that just lost over time? I mean, that's kind of sad.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the amount of variability in the continental hotspots. So CRB and AFAR, and my sort of general sense as a non-geochemist is that the continental crust sort of like messes everything up.
Yeah.
But I don't have a lot of intuition for how that works for volatiles.
Sure. So the continental crust is going to be uranium rich.
Gotcha.
And so you're going to
produce all from radiogenic.
Right. So you have radiogenic helium 4, and so let's say you had a nice less degassed plume coming up under a continent. That less degassed signature might crop up, but a lot of it's going to be contaminated with that crustal helium 4.
But following the thought, I think generally you're saying a high helium 3 or high helium 4 3 ratio is more degassed, but especially if you're in the continental crust with 10 times, 100 times more uranium than in the mantle, I would almost think it could be not degassed at all, but you'd still have a very high ratio.
Sure. If it's in the continental crust, it probably is degassed in terms of since it erupted. But this is sort of an interpretation from mantle reservoirs from which this melt arose.
Kind of actually piggybacking off of Scott's comment, the high mu basalts, I mean, this is supposed to be high radiogenic lead to primordial lead,
mm-hmm.
right? So that would imply more uranium in the high mu. So again, the high mu basalts should have more uranium, which would have more, I guess that would be more indicative of more of the source than of degassing, right?
So it should be both. It would have a high uranium to helium 3 ratio. So that's an interesting point. These high mu ocean island basalts are more radiogenic than the other ocean island basalts, but not by that much. So that's an interesting observation because what it tells you, if you had just purely, completely degassed altered oceanic crust and some uranium content, you could come up with the production ratio of helium 4 and then a trivial amount of helium 3. And you'd expect this ratio to be like 70 million instead of 100,000. And so you'd ask the question, why is this sitting at, say, 120,000 instead of 70 million? And I think the answer is that this ocean island basalt, even though it has high mu lead, it's not just pure recycled crust. It's got helium 3 from a less degassed mantle source, the plume source, mixing with it. And because the plume source is going to be gas rich compared to that very degassed altered oceanic crust, you're going to pull the isotopic ratio closer to the rest of the field. Yeah.
This is a naive question. In the classic geochemical Earth's model,
mm-hmm.
you would have the upper mantle as the source of the more, right? A very well mixed upper mantle.
Yeah.
And then you would have the lower mantle that would not mix with the upper mantle as the source for the OIBs.
Right, the very classic picture of the mantle, yeah.
And why then would you have so much variability in the OIBs, right? Because you would assume you have the upper mantle that is very well mixed and mm-hmm. the lower mantle that is very well mixed. But then what you see is that the morphs are very homogeneous in the sampling, but not the OIBs.
Wait, you lost me at one point. So the upper mantle, very well mixed and relatively homogeneous.
Yes.
So the
what about the lower mantle?
Right, so the plume source I think of as more heterogeneous in its radiogenic isotopes, be they strontium, neodymium, lead, or helium. So that's the observation, and that's why we sort of back construct our picture of the plume source in this way, as being more heterogeneous, less well mixed. Yeah. Okay. So if we go back to these sort of isotope diagrams. This is helium 3-4. I apologize. It was a notation that was very common all throughout the 90s and 2000s. We're trying to change it. This is now the inverse of what we've been talking about before, but I've labeled on the y-axis, less degassed is up here, more degassed down here. And so here's our high mu component. This is strontium 8786, so this is radiogenic over stable. And you have fields shown for Hawaii, Iceland, Easter, a whole bunch of mid-ocean ridge basalt, St. Helena, San Miguel, and then Samoa going off towards EM2. I didn't know that, Microsoft. Really? Later. Okay. So again, we have relatively low 3-4, so more degassed helium in the high mu. DM is sort of above that. EM2 goes down towards more degassed or radiogenic helium. And then there's this field that's labeled FEM. So this is primitive helium mantle back in the day where everyone wanted to name their own component. And so this is data from 1992. If we look at a more recent compilation, this is from Jackson et al, 2007. Again, more degassed on the y-axis is the bottom of the y-axis, and then less degassed above. You have depleted MORBs, Hawaii, Iceland, Galapagos, the Samoan field. The point that I want to make here is that plumes are characterized by high helium 3-4, Hawaii, Iceland, Galapagos, but you also have mixing towards more radiogenic components. So for each of these chains, you see there are mixing trends. So you don't have a homogeneous component sampled at each ocean island chain. You have mixing between different components. That was true in strontium and neodymium and lead, and it's true of helium as well. So we can ask ourselves, are the heavy noble gases, as we get better and better at measuring these, are the new data that are coming in consistent with this degassing interpretation? So if we're going to think about heavy noble gases, the first thing we have to contend with is post-eruptive atmospheric contamination. Helium is minimally contaminated because there are relatively high concentrations in the rocks and then low concentrations in the atmosphere because helium can escape from the atmosphere. The heavy noble gases, neon, argon, krypton, and xenon, are pervasively contaminated during and after eruption. So there's still questions about where, when, and how. Does this contamination happen on the seafloor during eruption? Does it happen once you dredge the rock, you decompress it, maybe you have microfractures and those fill with atmosphere and those microfractures heal? It's an absorption over time. The more we can constrain these mechanisms, the better we can, the better job we can do of minimizing atmospheric contamination of new samples. So the way that we measure heavy noble gases is typically by step crushing. So you take a sample, this is 5.3 grams of glass from the Southwest Indian Ridge, scale bar in centimeters. And if you load this into a small cup, what we would do is take a stainless steel ram and compress a bellows, all under vacuum, to crush the sample. Now, we wouldn't want to pulverize it right away. We want to release a little bit of gas at a time. The reason for that is that if you can step crush the sample, so stepped crushing means a little bit of crushing at a time on a single sample, then every time you're crushing the sample, you're rolling the dice. How much mantle gas, how much atmospheric gas am I going to get? So if you roll the dice over and over again, if you're lucky, you get a mixing array. So you'll get different amounts of atmospheric gas and mantle gas each time. So these varying proportions, if it's a nice, well-behaved system, you'll get a well-characterized mixing array between atmosphere and the mantle. So I'm going to show some data from four locations. Plume data from Iceland and the Rochambeau Rift. And those of you who are familiar with this area would be like, wait, that's a back arc. Go ahead. Don't throw it.
So just before you talk about the results, you're talking about air mixing, but then you're also talking about it being in a vacuum. So how, I'm confused by that.
So the atmospheric contamination has become sort of intrinsic to the rock already. So then you've put that sample in your chamber, you've pumped that sample down. If you were super lucky, all the atmospheric contamination would be pumped away when you pump it down to vacuum, but that's not what happens. So that atmospheric contamination is trapped with the sample.
So it's trapped with the sample, but it's not trapped with the mantle gas. It's in like two different pockets, perhaps, in the rock. Is that kind of
possibly,
what you're saying?
Potentially. Okay. It sort of depends on how it happens. One would hope, because then you could remove the atmospheric contamination without having to like break open conduits to mantle gas. Yeah. Okay. So plume-related sample from Iceland, and then the Rochambeau Rift, where you have Samoan plume material being sampled at a back arc, and then samples from the Equatorial Atlantic, Southwest Indian Ridge, and I didn't put a dot here, but I'll also show the popping rock data in a couple slides. That's from 14 North on the Atlantic. So correcting for atmospheric contamination, this is an example in neon isotope space. So anytime you look at an isotope-isotope diagram, the first thing you should look at is the denominator on the X and Y axes. If the denominator is the same in X and Y, then mixing is linear in this space. So if mixing is linear, you're super happy. Yes, we know how to fit this. It's relatively straightforward. So here I've shown multiple step crushes for two rocks that came up in the same dredge. The atmospheric composition is sitting down here. This is two primordial isotopes, neon 20 and 22. And the atmosphere has a ratio of about 9.8. Now the mantle has a ratio of these primordial isotopes that's higher, either 12.5, some people think it has to be higher, 13.4. And then on the x-axis, this is your nucleogenic neon produced by alpha-N reactions, and then the primordial isotope. So my step crush data are defining this nice, nice mixing array. That makes me very happy, same thing over here. And what I can do is fit a line to this data. In this case, because you don't have a dependent and independent variable, these are both observations, and you have uncertainties in both the x and y axis, you're not just minimizing y residuals. This is going to be an orthogonal least fit, least squares fit. So similar to what Ved was talking about, but now you're trying to find the minimal distance orthogonal to the line of best fit. So you find your best fit line, and then you say, okay, if there had been no atmospheric contamination, my model mantle has a 20-22 ratio sitting up here. So what's my mantle source 21-22 ratio? That's how we're doing the correction for atmospheric contamination. We're saying all this variation is due to post-eruptive contamination. And if we had measured the mantle gas before it was atmospherically contaminated, it would be sitting up here. And so then we can compare different locations at a 20-22 of 12.5 and then interpret the variations in the 21-22. Does it make sense why you can't do that without the atmospheric contamination correction? Because otherwise, you'd be comparing a whole cluster of data that's reflecting a different process, atmospheric contamination rather than degassing.
Rita, before Scott gets to his question, I have a question. What decays into 21 neon again? I forgot.
So it was alpha decay of, say, uranium and thorium. That alpha particle reacts with oxygen 18, for example, and that will produce neon 21 and a neutron.
So that's why the atmosphere has so much of it, or so little of it. Wait, I'm confused, because you told us that the gas was on the right, and now the mantle is
the atmosphere.
The gas
is,
and the atmosphere.
So the atmosphere is this weird noble gas reservoir, and we're trying to understand its origins is a completely distinct story, complementary but distinct story for the atmosphere, for the mantle. Yeah.
So I'm a little confused. How do you know the mantle 20-22 ratio?
Okay, so there are sort of, I think of them as model and member 2022 values. So the first question you can ask yourself is, what is the highest 2022 ratio we've ever measured in a mantle derived sample? And I think that's a good place to start. And then you compare that to meteorites, and you're like, okay, what 2022 ratios are common in these different meteorite components? So 12.5 was in vogue in the mid-2000s because there's a component called neon B, which you see in meteorites, but that might be related to a process that's maybe relevant, maybe not relevant in the early solar system. So the solar wind is a higher 2022 ratio. And I think Curtis is the person to talk to sort of about variations in the highest 2022 you've measured. Yep.
So I have absolutely no idea about this process of grabbing the rock and getting it into the lab, but it sounds like you have a lot of trouble trying to correct for these atmospheric contamination of the rock. And yep. It sounds like a big part of this contamination happens during sampling the rock, bringing it up to the ship, bringing it into the lab, and then analyzing it.
Yeah.
Is there anything you can do about that? Uh-huh. Like, could you just like...
yes, yeah, we
dredge
have...
Dredge it, put it under pressure, vacuum seal it at the seafloor, bring it into the lab, and then analyze
so
it.
So if you are flush with cash, you would have an ROV grab the rock, stick it inside a steel canister, seal that canister at pressure in the seawater, and then bring it up.
Exactly.
Did Mark Kurtz manage to do that? He did. Okay. If you're not flush with cash and you thought about this a week before you went on an oceanographic cruise like we did, then you get an ultra pure nitrogen gas tank. And you ask your friends who do anoxic bacteria stuff how they managed to do their sampling. And what we did was, as soon as glass was brought up to the surface, within 15 to 30 minutes, we sealed it up in a pure nitrogen atmosphere. So those were samples that were bottled. When I said I woke up all my friends at 3 a.m., it was because I needed their help to put this glass into bottles. So there are different experiments that are being done to see if you could try to remove gas, atmospheric gas that's already sort of found its way into cracks, or it would be best if you could get rid of it at the source. Yeah. Okay. Is this clear, the way that we're doing this correction? So neon isotopes, this is a nice linear space, and we have these three isotopes we can work with, all of which we can measure on our mass spectrometers with relative ease. This was a point about precision. As we get better and better techniques, we're getting better and better at resolving mixing arrays. And so that opens up the number of samples that we can get mantle source compositional estimates for. So the point of this is to say that in this data array, or on this plot here, this line that says MORB, this is a paper about East Pacific Rise data, which are all the data, but that line that says MORB was the popping rock line. It was this famous 2 pi D43, famous very vesicular rock, that people were just like, that's MORB, and we will compare everything else to that. And so as you get better and better precision, what it lets you do is get away from anomalously gas-rich rocks. You're no longer limited to these anomalously gas-rich rocks. And so you can try to characterize parts of the mantle that are maybe producing gas-poor samples, not just the gas-rich ones. Okay, so the goal is high-precision data in typical gas-poor mantle drive samples. All right, when we get to argon, it gets a little more complicated. The keen-eyed among you would notice that there were two primordial isotopes of argon, but it's difficult to measure 38. And so what we need to do is plot argon 4036 against our familiar neon 2022. So air is down here at the bottom corner. The mantle neon 2022, I think, is at 12.5. And then I looked at my denominator, and they're different. Uh-oh. So mixing in the space is not linear, it's hyperbolic. And so you can do a best fit, but it's no longer trivial, right? So you have errors in X and Y, and you want to do a hyperbolic best fit. And if you're interested in this topic, come talk to me. I have a lot of thoughts about it. Yes?
So is mixing hyperbolic because the denominator is different now?
Yeah, so the denominator is different, so mixing will depend on the concentration contrast between the two reservoirs. So if you imagine this is reservoir A and reservoir B, this curvature is telling that you change the neon first, so reservoir B has a high neon-argon ratio. So adding a little bit of reservoir B nudged the neon isotopic composition without really changing the argon isotopic composition. So the strength of that curvature depends on the concentration contrast between the two mixing components. Yeah.
So if you removed the top two data points, I'm not sure if the one that's filled in is an actual data point.
Oh no, that's our fit with its uncertainties.
So if you remove the point at 15,000,
then it would just go out like this.
It would be linear, yeah.
Yeah. So that's why you hope for data points that are less atmospherically contaminated. So it's kind of the luck of the draw. As you're step crushing, you get what you get. Okay, so this is showing the mantle source compositions estimated for these two mixing arrays. And this is actually a relatively well-behaved system. If you look at a typical rock, it's unlikely that it's actually going to look like this. The reason for that is that you might have contamination with atmospheric gas, but also seawater dissolved atmospheric gas. And so that seawater dissolved gas has a different elemental abundance pattern. So you will have a different curvature for that mixing. But if things behave nicely, we're very happy and we can have a higher certainty fit. Okay, so then for xenon isotopes, xenon 129, 130, you could do the same thing with neon 2022. In this case, I've shown it against argon 4036. Different denominators, hyperbolic mixing. Atmosphere in the bottom left corner, and then our data arrays, and then the hyperbola of best fit. So the important thing that I want to point out here is that the curvature of these hyperbolas is concave down. And that's really nice, because it means that for data sets like this, this has asymptoted pretty much at its estimated mantle 4036. So if you were to say, OK, you actually underestimated your 4036, you should have gone further to the right, the xenon isotopic composition actually doesn't care that much, right? You could go further to the right on this hyperbola, and you'd still be below 7, right? Not going to be at 7.8. And so even though you might have more scatter, the curvature of the hyperbola is helping us in these argon xenon plots. So the takeaways so far, you have pervasive atmospheric contamination, primary systematics reflecting syn to post-eruptive contamination are going to give you those mixing arrays in the measured data. So if we can get a clear mantle air mixing array, then we can try to say something about the source composition. So if I can say something about the source, then I can go back to that question. Do my neon, argon, and xenon systematics jive with what we see in the helium? And I'll just show three plots real quick. That'll be when I wrap up. So this is helium versus neon. And I've shown both axes with the radiogenic nuclide on the numerator. So high helium 4-3 is more degassed, and high neon 21-22 is more degassed. So if these are coherent, then we'll see a positive relationship. So these are samples from a plume-influenced mid-ocean ridge basalt, and then Iceland. And then these are a bunch of mid-ocean ridge basalts, including the Popping Rock. And what you can see is that things with low helium 4-3 also have low 21-22, and the converse is also true. So that's nice. Helium and neon isotope systematics are coherent. How about argon? Argon 4036, more degassed is high, same as helium 4-3. And again, for plumes, you have low argon 4036, and morbs tend to have higher argon 4036. And then you look at this and you're like, what's that? Wait a second. So this is the western orthogonal supersegment of the Southwest Indian Ridge. This is the eastern orthogonal supersegment of the Southwest Indian Ridge. And the really interesting thing here is that there's quite a bit of variation in argon 4036 of the mantle source, with very limited variation in helium 4-3. So they're both sensitive to degassing on the same timescale, but we're not seeing what's predicted. We're seeing a lower 4036 at that helium 4-3. And you're like, okay, what about the xenon? So xenon 129, 130 versus helium 4-3. Plumes are down here with low xenon 129, 130. The morbs that were up where we expected in argon and neon are up where we expected in xenon 129, 130. And then those eastern orthogonal supersegment samples, again, have this low 129, 130 without shifting their helium isotopes. So you look at that and you're like, huh, wait, how do we interpret this y-axis again? So 129 is only produced by iodine 129, which was short-lived. And so this is more early degassing, not the long-term degassing. And then if you were to plot the atmospheric composition on this, it would be down by 6.5. So the atmosphere has low 129, 130. And so you look at this and you're like, but we've already corrected for atmospheric contamination. This is the composition at neon 2022 of 12.5. So what's going on in the eastern orthogonal supersegment? And so the hypothesis was that this low argon and the low 129-130 in this region of the Southwest Indian Ridge reflected recycling of atmospheric gas into the mantle and incorporation of that into the upper mantle beneath the Southwest Indian Ridge. So subduction zones, when I said they were once thought to be efficient barriers to recycling of noble gases, what we're starting to see is that there's evidence that air-saturated seawater noble gases or atmospheric gases trapped in hydrous phases are recycled. So I'm going to stop here because I'm out of time, but we'll pick up with this and more about the xenon isotopic signature next week. All right.
So you just said that, can you go back a slide or two slides? This one. So you say that the East OSS is, and that dichotomy is showing subduction of atmosphere, but couldn't you also say that they're sampling different MORB sources, one that's has early degassing and one that does not have early degassing? That just shows mantle heterogeneity?
So that would be an ancient heterogeneity that's been preserved at a 600-kilometer length scale. Yeah, it's physically tenuous in my mind. But you could try to test that with other noble gas systematics. So in this case, if I were to show you xenon-xenon plots, the eastern orthogonal supersegment versus western, the mantle source for the eastern is on a trend between the western orthogonal supersegment and air. So it's consistent with mixing in of atmospheric gas. Yeah.
So what gives you such large uncertainties in the xenon measurements compared to some of the other systems?
Right. So it's a very low abundance of the rock. And you're fighting against a system that is, if you don't clean it very well, could have a high blank. And so when Sudra and I do these measurements, we're waiting for the system blank to fall down to, say, 6 counts per second of xenon just from the system itself. So the stainless steel chambers that we process the gas in and the mass spectrometer itself. And so if you have a blank of, say, 6 counts per second and your signal is 150 counts per second, you have to count for a long time, but the signal is also decaying. So it's just statistical.
Are argon and xenon preferring to regas because they're heavier over neon and helium?
That's the thought. So the atmospheric helium contents are low because helium can escape. There are people who have been doing great solubility measurements of all the different gases in phases like amphibole, serpentinite, some ring minerals.
Would you expect krypton to act the same way?
I would expect so. So if we get mantle krypton data, we can try to look for that, yeah.
So what are the two other points there, near MOBS EA and 2 pi D43?
Sorry, yes, this is equatorial Atlantic. This is Jonathan Tucker's samples. And then 2 pi D43 is the popping rock.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess that negates a bit my other questions. But I mean, the Western OSS is also much closer to the Bouvet plume. And in fact, geologically speaking, there might have been potential for contamination from that.
Right. So it
compared
is
compared to the eastern side.
It is more than 500 kilometers away from the Bouvet plume, but it is
today,
closer.
Today. The trace of the plume, actually, if you look at it, if you go a few million years in the past, you're much closer.
Yeah. I've had some chats with just Jessica Warren about this. Yeah.
Unrelated, and maybe this is something more to do over the coffee, but I started to wonder about the air in some of your diagram, because it's a very small point there in many places.
Oh, the air, yes.
Yes, the air, you know, the contamination, the thing you don't want to care about.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm also not sure I understand it, and maybe I'm not the only one for that, but if you go back to, say, the plot you had, yeah, one of those, whichever one. No, the
linear,
next one.
Linear, hyperbolic,
actually.
Okay.
So there's almost no argon 40 in air, according to this diagram, right?
Yes. So,
there's almost no results of kind of, you know, mantle decay product type of things. However, in helium, mm-hmm. has low helium-3, therefore it has a high helium-4, which means a lot of those decay products, unless I'm completely backward after spinning on my head three times.
Nope, that's right.
So I don't understand how these things has no these decay products of the potassium and a lot of decay products of everything else.
Okay. So the neon is going to be affected by a separate process. There's mass fractionation occurring between the primordial components that would deliver noble gases to the Earth. So if you look at solar wind and then a bunch of meteorites, they fall along a mass fractionation line. And so the atmosphere is along that mass fractionation line in neon. With the argon, I think Sudra would have a readier answer. No?
You have the mic.
So the mantle is more radiogenic and it's outgassing, but the argon budget of the atmosphere is so large that that impact is limited. So even though you have more radiogenic helium in the atmosphere, that reflects the fact that there's less helium in the atmosphere. So the punch of degassing is stronger.
We also said that the air had a lot of argon at all because of decay products, but that would have to be a lot of argon 40,
okay,
which doesn't work with what this ratio tells me there. This ratio tells me it has a lot of argon 36, not argon 40.
So it has a lot of argon, and a higher proportion of that argon is 36. Yes. So the timing of the outgassing, if you had established the atmospheric argon budget early, the impact of degassing over time is going to depend on the argon budget versus the outgassing flux. So what I'm saying is that the small change over time would be because of that difference. But I get what you're saying. Where did all the 40 come from? It's not that much 40. Yeah.
So in other words, the argon budget of the atmosphere has very little to do with potassium.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said that.
So even though that looks like it's zero, it's actually a number that's close to 300.
Yeah.
And to put that in context, the solar system initial 4036 was 10 to the minus 4, meaning there was no argon 40 at the start of the solar system. So all of the argon 40 that you're seeing in the atmosphere was generated from decay of potassium.
Any other questions? People are impatient for their coffee.
Yes.
Has anyone made coffee? Kanani's on it? Okay, great. Okay, well, let's thank Rita.